rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. In the second hour of our program, Scott Ritter is going to be here, the former UNSCOM senior weapons inspector in Iraq between 1991 and 1998. He just came back from Iran. It should be interesting. In the third hour of our program, Laura Flanders is going to drop by. She and I are doing a panel this weekend at the Bioneers Conference. Right now, Mark Stein is with us. He's the author of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It. His name is spelled S-T-E-Y-N, and the reason that's relevant is because his website is Stein, S-T-E-Y-N, online.com, if you want more information about him and his book. Hey, Mark, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. Your book, I found it informative and troubling. And let me start with the troubling part, the part that concerned me. One of the ways that America was, to some extent, I would say, fleeced during the 40s, 50s, and 60s was by hyping the threat of communism, which at the same time that the CIA internally was telling us this thing is imploding, and particularly in the 70s and 80s, this system is imploding. And it seems that one of the consistent instruments of power that political regimes all around the world use is to identify an other and hyper-villainize them. And your book is about the threat of radical Islam to the United States. And my concern is, please inform me if there's something I'm missing here. My concern is that your book is not so much addressing what we might be able to do to resolve this issue as it is essentially saying, here's how bad it is. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
It's not. I mean, I agree with you on the basic idea that you should always have a realistic threat assessment. Now, I happen to disagree. I think in the 40s. Communism was a real threat. In the space of a couple of years after the Second World War, it gobbled up Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Yugoslavia. It was turned back in Greece only by a very small British military intervention. It took China. You have to believe an awful lot in American exceptionalism to believe that the rest of the world can kind of fall apart and America can survive and prosper on its own. And my analysis in the book is really that there are fast-moving trends occurring in Europe and among other critical nations among America's allies. And that the best way to turn back what is happening is for America to recover its own cultural confidence. You know, your magnificent intro about standing up for democracy, I'm not arguing for a big government solution to the decline of the West. I'm saying that every individual basically needs to understand that his civilizational inheritance, the right to live in liberty and freedom, and to celebrate the great American virtues of self-reliance, that is something we need to do as individuals, and that is our best weapon against this threat and all the other ones likely to arise.
But I would say, okay, agreed. And I would submit to you that conservatives like yourself and the neoconservatives have, lacking the Soviet Union anymore as a boogeyman, have come to the American people and said, okay, we've got a new boogeyman, and therefore you should give us a lot of power and a lot of money because we need to go after this new boogeyman because we've all of a sudden discovered that there's this thing, this radical Islam out there, and it's now a new war of civilizations. And without a war of civilizations, the conservatives and neoconservatives really don't have a claim to power.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that, Tom, at all. As I said, I'm not really interested in the so-called big government solutions. I think every time you go to an airport here and they make you take your shoes off and they say, no, you can't take toothpaste on, I think that's all rubbish. That kind of big blow. I was opposed to the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. In fact, I do believe I was the only columnist to call for the firings of a lot of agency heads after September 11th, precisely because all the big government acronyms had completely failed and flopped. And I do not believe that this is something that needs a big government solution. It, in a sense, it's gone beyond that, because what is the what is rotting, if you take the rest of the developed world, what is rotting them from within is a kind of crisis of confidence among individuals. And we have that to a certain degree in this country. You know, I mean, everybody who's got a kid in grade school, and the child comes home and he reports on what he's been taught that day by teacher, and teacher's peddling some sort of cockamamie, culturally relativist nonsense, and you basically roll your eyes and put up with it and say, what can you do? Well, you need to do something about it, because unless this generation is raised to understand that its values are worth celebrating and that they're precious and need defending, then basically we're not likely to survive and prosper. And Islam is a real threat to that in that sense.
So it sounds to me like what you're saying is essentially what General Boykin said: my God is bigger than their God, or my God is better than their God, or some variation on that.
Well, it's not about God, but look, the reality is that there are now millions of Pakistanis living in Scandinavia, Northern Europe. If you come from Pakistan, that's not a comfortable climate.
Wait a minute, you mean because people? It's not a comfortable climate because their skin is brown?
No, it's not a comfortable climate because it's cold. It's like if I come from a hot country, lived in Canada for a long time, where it's winter 11 months of the year. If you come from a warm country, that's a very unpleasant place to be. What I'm saying is that there's millions of Pakistanis in Scandinavia. There are three Scandinavians in Pakistan. The traffic is all one way. And I think we're entitled to say that there are societies that have set themselves up on Earth that have managed to run themselves in a more effective, more efficient way. And I'm not prepared...
You're saying Pakistan is? I mean, this sounds to me like the migration of people from a poor country to a wealthy country.
No, I'm saying Pakistan isn't. I'm saying that it's absurd to pretend, as cultural relativists do, that there's no distinction to be made between American society and Dutch society and New Zealand society, and on the other hand...
I don't know anybody who's making that argument, Mark.
Well, you do. You do. You hear that all the time. That essentially...
I only hear that from right-wingers who claim that they hear it from left-wingers.
That's not the case. I mean, for example, the argument that's made over the so-called neocon project in the Middle East is that somehow the Muslim world is unfit for democracy, that in a sense their cultural tradition is mired...
No, that's not the argument that's made. The argument that's made is that democracy cannot flourish without a strong middle class, and that when you try to impose democracy on a people who don't have a strong middle class, they will vote for an autocrat.
And we're seeing that
in the Palestinian territories. We're seeing that in Iraq. We're seeing that, right across not just the Middle East.
And I absolutely agree with you on that, Tom. I mean, if we're picking models here,
that's not moral relativism, though. That's Econ 101.
If you say to me that I'm just in favor of holding an election in the Middle East, I'm not. I'm interested, though, in exploring ways in which you can plant the seeds of liberty. For example, Hong Kong and Singapore were not what Americans would regard as democratic societies, but they had that middle class that you talked about. They had the principles of liberty. They had a free judiciary, free press, and they had the law of contract and property rights and all that. And the election day is the last piece of the puzzle in that. You get those foundational structures right, and then you hold the election. It's the last piece of the puzzle. And
Well, that's my point too. I mean, but you're arguing essentially that Islam is the enemy, and I'm arguing that the radicals within Islam are able to exploit essentially poverty and the lack of a middle class, which were exacerbated by many of our policies.
Well, I'm not going to defend American policies in the Middle East in the 1950s and 1960s, because I think they and right up until...
Or even today, our continuing support of the Saudi regime.
Yeah, I think the Saudi... that the Frankensaud monster is a creation of the United States, of which United States presidents and administrations of both stripes should be profoundly ashamed. It's a disgusting state. It's a disgusting...
And yet they are the best friends of the Bush administration, who you seem to hold in high regard.
Well, not when it comes to that. When it comes to that scene of President Bush strolling around his yard in Crawford, holding hands with King Abdullah, as he now is, I think that was a moment of great shame for the United States. The reality of the situation is that the Saudis are the chief exporter of ideology, and that country is a creation of the U.S., yeah. And that was a huge mistake.
And the point you make in your book is that they export radical Islam more than they export oil, and I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Mark Stein, we got to wrap it up. STEYNonline.com, the website. The book is America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
Great pleasure, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
When should you send to a mentor a friend of the channels that have broken down? Now you bring it up, I'm going to ring it up just to hear you sing it out. Step from the road to the sea to the sky, and if you believe what we rely on, when I lay it on, come get the play it on, on my life to sacrifice. Hey, oh.
And welcome back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. Yes, you can support our program by supporting our sponsors. Some great folks. Certainly contact the local sponsors that you hear in your local station. And also our national sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, for example. Saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, their website. And they have a fall sale going on right now. If you type the word fall, as in autumn, F-A-L-L, into the coupon field at checkout, you can get a 15% discount, which is really great. And they've got a whole bunch of great stuff. Sampler pack now, 4 to 6 ounce samples of coffee. Great gift. Their telephone number, 1-800-425-2532. You can claim your discount that way, too. 1-800-425-2532. And Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS. SmallDog.com, their website. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Some remarkable stories in the news here. The two that really popped out at me this morning from the Wall Street Journal, oddly enough, or maybe not. The first we've mentioned a number of times. In fact, yesterday in our debate with David Tebow about whether or not we should have single-payer health care in the United States, or whether we should continue to walk around with these giant leeches attached to our back known as the for-profit health care system of the United States. This from the front page of the B section, the marketplace section of the Wall Street Journal, page B1. United Healthcare's McGuire. This is Bill McGuire, William McGuire. We've talked about many times on this program. This, first of all, United Health Group is the largest of the companies that are selling these donut hole insurance programs. You know, where the government helps you buy insurance from a for-profit company to insure yourself, to get discounts for Medicare, not so much for the donut holes, but pre- and post-donut holes, to get discount the Medicare discount cards. And as the one of the largest beneficiaries of this government largesse, this company's making some serious bucks. And as a result of that, they paid their CEO, William McGuire, last year. It was reported that last year he made $1.78 billion. That's $1,780 million. $1,788 millions of dollars. $1 million, 1,780 times. In 1 year. That was his compensation. Well, now it looks like maybe he or folks in his company were jiggering around the timing on their stock options in order to inflate the value of them. And so he's apparently walking away from the company. And it doesn't look like he's going to be prosecuted for this. In fact, here's just the first paragraph of the story by Charles Farrell and Mark Miramont. United Health Group Inc.'s soon-to-be former chief executive, William McGuire, could walk away from the company with about $1.1 billion in stock options, retirement payouts, and other benefits, according to an examination of securities filings. The $1.1 that he could retain would be on top of about $530 million that he's earned since 1992 running United Health. So that's on top of his, you know, regular paycheck. Gee. They go on to say, in addition, under his employment contract, Dr. McGuire is entitled to an executive pension that will pay him a lump sum of $6.4 million plus about $5.1 million a year for the rest of his life. His wife will receive half of that each year if she outlives him. So there's a pension. Now, keep in mind, pensions are what companies are aggressively doing away with. Pensions are like Social Security, where you get a fixed amount for, often adjusted for inflation, but you get a check every month for the rest of your life, and it stops when you die. As opposed to savings, this is called a defined benefit plan, as opposed to savings plans, basically, 401ks, where you save up money throughout your working lifetime, and then you hope that you don't get hit by a medical emergency, and you hope that you can live on that money. The contract also provides that Dr. McGuire and his wife are entitled to lifetime health care coverage, as well as health coverage until age 25 for his children. He also gets to keep using the company's jet for personal business. He gets a company-paid office and secretary for 3 years, company-paid allowance for security and tax and financial planning expenses as well. In addition, the company could keep him on as a consultant for 3 years at roughly his current cash pay, $8 to $10 million a year. The company must also pay his disability and other insurance premiums for 3 years, including premiums on a special $5.5 million life insurance policy. And they go on to say, this is from the Wall Street Journal, if payments to Dr. McGuire run afoul of federal golden parachute taxes, United Health is obliged to pay the excise tax plus any state or federal taxes that he owes because of this. It is called being grossed up. It's really gross, right? So here you have the CEO aristocracy in America. And what is the CEO aristocracy in America bringing us, particularly with regard to health care? They're bringing us 45, 46 million uninsured Americans. And increasingly, if you get sick and you are insured, you're going to find that your biggest opponent is not the illness. It's the health insurance company. Now, on top of that, today, China hit a $1 trillion holding in foreign reserve debt. And that is perhaps even worse news. We'll get to that in just a second. 27 minutes past the hour. The multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Harbin here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, we're up to, as I recall, like 700-800 people, something like that, have already signed up for the Great Debate 2, which will be at the University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium on Friday, a week from Friday, Friday, October 27th, where I'm going to be debating, along with Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, and local progressive comedian Johnny Steele, going to be debating Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, and Rusty Humphreys, a debate moderated by the Honorable Willie Brown. You must have tickets, although they are free. And you can get them over at quakeradio.com. This is sponsored by KNEW and by The Quake, KQKE in San Francisco, which, of course, carries this program. So get over there to quakeradio.com and get a bunch of friends, and we need a big cheering section. This auditorium will hold 3,000 people. Let's see if we can make this thing really a hoot. Here's what's going on. I've got to tell you what's going on with China, because this is mind-boggling, and there's some really mind-boggling pieces to this. Andrew Brown writing in today's Wall Street Journal, China's reserves near milestone, underscoring its financial clout. What is happening is that one of the most powerful economies in the world is now a dictatorship. I mean, people say, well, we need to be afraid of radical Islam. Well, radical Islam is a problem, but it's nothing, I'm telling you, it's nothing compared to what's going on in the boardrooms and in the banking centers of the world, and the relationship between this country and China with regard to trade. Sometime in the next few days, China's holdings of foreign currencies, this is from Andrew Brown in the Wall Street Journal, China's holdings of foreign currencies and securities will top $1 trillion, a sum greater than the annual economic output of all but nine countries. Now, this isn't China's output. This isn't China's GDP. This is the amount of debt that they're holding, the amount of cash that they're sitting on. Much of it denominated in dollars, much of it from the U.S. In fact, as the Wall Street Journal notes, most of China's currency reserves are invested in U.S. dollar-denominated debt, such as U.S. treasuries. And it's growing at the rate of $20 billion a month. They go on to note that that has kept demand for U.S. treasury notes high and interest rates low. A change in that pattern, in other words, if the Chinese decide to say, we're not going to buy these things anymore, could affect how much Americans pay for mortgage loans and other borrowings. I would take it a step further. I would say if China decided to stop buying U.S. debt, we might see interest rates in this country go up to 10, 15, 20% very quickly. Because the government would have to start offering more interest in order to get people to buy its debt. And we sure are selling a lot of debt. This is how the Bush administration borrows money to give it to the defense contractors so that they can make it look like the economy is working and they can fight wars and things without having to tax their buddies, the millionaires and billionaires. In fact, as the Wall Street Journal notes today, some in Washington and in world markets fear, and it's a legitimate fear, that China may one day dump its holdings of dollar-based assets, setting off a tidal wave of sales that might swamp the U.S. economy. They're going to say roughly 70% of the Chinese reserves are believed to be in U.S. dollar assets. This is amazing. This week, the U.S. passed 300 million in population, and this week, China passed $1 trillion in foreign debt that they're sitting on. They go on to note in the Wall Street Journal, as China's reserves balloon, markets and many U.S. officials believe it may be buying less U.S. Treasury debt and more debt issued by U.S. mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Well, that's interesting. In other words, they're propping up our housing market right now. China's reserves already far exceed what that country needs to protect its economy from global financial shocks. $1 trillion is roughly 1.25 to 1.5 times China's total import bill last year, and equivalent to roughly 45% of the year's economic output. The total could pay off China's total short-term foreign debt 6 times over. In other words, we have become the debtors. We have become the third world nation. We're the ones who've been wiped out by 26 years of insane trade and economic policies, starting with Reagan, continued by Bush, continued by Clinton, and now continued by Bush again. And who has become the first world nation? Who has become the world's banker? Who has become the wealthy nation? Who has become the nation sitting on so much money that and so much of our debt that if they say, okay, guys, pay up, it could throw us into something even worse than the Great Depression? China. The communist dictatorship of China. The composition of its dollar assets suggests that China is a more sophisticated portfolio manager than Japan, they note. The flimsiest reports from China on the management of its reserves can cause gyrations in global markets. They note in May, remember when gold went up to 700 and something? They say in May, for instance, China Gold News, leading industry publication in China, carried comments from a Chinese economist who said China should raise its holding of gold from 600 tons to 2,500 tons. He doesn't speak for China. He was just talking about it. He's a part-time economist. As a result of that, gold prices spiked all around the world. Everybody said, China's going to buy gold. Oh, off it goes. In the meantime, by spending a large chunk of its national savings to buy U.S. debt, China is helping keep mortgage rates in the U.S. low at a time when money could be put to better use in its own huge developing economy, at least in the or could be put to use. So what's the bottom line of all this? Well, the bottom line of all this is that because we are running a debt-based foreign trade system and a debt-based economy, this crazed Reaganomics, Clintonomics, the Reaganomics domestically, Clintonomics, well, really it's Friedmanomics, Friedmanism, Tom Friedmanism, internationally, we're being wiped out, the United States. I mean, there's just really no other way to say it. We are being wiped out. For example, this is from economyincrisis.org, which is a great website that lays this stuff out. America is hemorrhaging its wealth. And this is literally true. I mean, we are literally bleeding our net assets, our wealth, at the rate of $723 billion a year through our balance of trade deficit. This equates to over $1.4 million per minute flowing into foreign hands. This is the money foreigners use to buy us out. We've sold over 8,000 companies in the last 10 years. And then they look at a period, just a two-month period, from March 23rd to May 23rd. This was a report that was written at in early June. So it was, it says in just the last 2 months alone, from March 23rd to May 23rd, we have sold 94 major American companies or major interests in major divisions of them for over $10,187,000,000. See, these companies overseas, they're sitting on all these dollars because of our insane trade policies. What are they going to do with them? They come back and they buy us. Equity One Inc. Properties, for example. $388 million worth of that company was bought by interest in Bahrain. Gillette Company, deodorant brands, $420 million worth of that company bought by interest in Germany. Interchange Financial Services, $480 million bought by Canadians. J. Jill Group, $516 million bought by Japan. AOL Time Warner's Book Group, $537 million worth of that company bought by France, or people in France, interest in France. Lifeline Systems, $738 million worth of that company bought from the Netherlands. Aero Technologies, $765 million bought from Germany. American Medical Holdings, $785 million of that company bought from Canada. Pioneer Natural Resources, $1.3 billion bought by the Japanese. AWAS, $2.5 billion bought by those in the United Kingdom. And then they go on to say the sale of Pioneer Natural Resources, for example. This is a good example. This is the one the Japanese bought for $1.3 billion. It shows what happens. They own Gulf of Mexico assets. Okay, in other words, the right to explore in 97 exploration and production blocks and six producing fields to explore for oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, you would think that if somebody finds oil in the Gulf of Mexico, that that's going to benefit the United States, right? I mean, you would think that. No. That's the problem. If now the profit from that oil found in the Gulf of Mexico by Pioneer Natural Resources is going to go to Japan. They go on to note that $2 per, this includes 30,000 barrels of oil equivalent production per day, approximately 630,000 gallons of refined gasoline a day. At $2 a gallon gas, this investment could be paid off in less than 3 years. The sale of our wealth-producing companies or assets like Pioneer will hasten the day when America reverts to the former colonial status we had in the 17th century. From this sale alone, we're going to pay Japan to use our own oil and gasoline. I mean, this is 90% of our footwear companies are now foreign-owned. Or, excuse me, of our footwear is foreign-manufactured. 87% of our audio and video equipment, foreign-manufactured. 86% of our leather products, foreign-manufactured. 75% of leather and hide tanning, foreign-done. 67% of our clothing, apparel, accessories, 67% foreign-produced. And so we send all that money overseas. So what do? They come over here and they buy our industries. Our sound recording industry, 97% foreign-owned. Commodity contracts dealing companies, 79% foreign-owned. Metal ore mining. You think people mining ore out of the ground in the United States would be American companies? Sorry, 65% foreign-owned. Our motion picture and video industries, that's an all-American industry, 64% foreign-owned. Motion picture and sound recording industry, 75% foreign-owned. As a result of these crazed policies. Hey, time now for our progressive pop quiz here on the Tom Hartman Program. CEO William McGuire of United Healthcare is leaving his company with more than how many dollars in compensation? The sixth caller with the correct answer, 1-866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of Screwed, 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question once again for the day was United Healthcare CEO William McGuire is leaving his company with how many dollars more than how many dollars in compensation. And congratulations to Carl Unger in Copley, Pennsylvania, with his answer, over $1,000 million. And Lauren says, I had to check with the judges for that one, and they accepted it. Yes, over $1 billion. And pretty mind-boggling. Over $1 billion. And that's for, like, this year's work. There's something really strange about that. Mark in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Mark, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for a great show. I wish I could get you in my car all the time. I can only get you for an hour here, and then I have to listen to you online back in my office. I really enjoyed your program yesterday, and I'm a doctor here in Ohio, and, you know, this UnitedHealthcare thing is disgusting. They, it seems that most of the people that make healthcare policy in this country either have no medical background or haven't seen a patient in 30 years and really have lost touch as far as what do their policies really mean to patients and to practicing physicians. You know, this guy you had on yesterday who was talking about, oh, it's the money-hungry doctors and lawyers. Let me tell you, I don't know of a lot of really super wealthy doctors. I mean, all of my colleagues and I, you know, we've seen our real income go down each year, yet our expenses have gone up.
Yep.
For example, my malpractice 5 years ago was $5,000. It's now $30,000, and I've never been sued.
Yeah, yeah.
And
actually, a large part of that increase is because the insurance companies that are selling malpractice insurance, number one, lost a lot of money when the stock market tanked, and so they
right.
had to jack up prices. And two, they're paying their executives hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, the... if you look in Ohio in the last 5-6 years, the number of malpractice cases filed has dropped each year, as have the awards. Yet, this is nothing but greed. You know, the insurance industry in general, and I put all insurance companies in there, is a totally unregulated, out of control system. And I mean, just look at the example of last year with Hurricane Katrina. You know, I think the only happy story out of that was that Trent Lott got stiffed on his insurance reimbursement too.
Well, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago about how the insurance industry that works in that field in disaster insurance is going to show a $60 billion profit this year because they jacked up everybody's rates as a result of Katrina, and now there
right.
wasn't another disaster, and so they're sitting on $60 billion and they're just going to distribute it to their stockholders and say, ha ha, our money.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, as a practicing physician, I see patients regardless of their ability to pay, because this is just me, but I feel I have to give something back.
Yeah,
you know,
I
can tell you, if I had no money and I went and my car broke down, I don't think I'd find a mechanic who had an ethical obligation to fix my car for free.
Yeah. And see, you're the kind of doctor, and frankly, every doc I've ever known, and I've got a few who are friends and certainly have, you know, through the course of my life, seen quite a few as doctors, has been there first and foremost because they love medicine and they care about caring for people. You know, they're
exactly.
You know, and you know, the story of the greedy doctor and the idea that what's his name, David, was putting forward yesterday that people should be allowed to go into medicine to make a killing. You know, no pun intended.
Yeah.
Just is bizarre to me. I think physicians should be well paid. You know, it's hard work. It takes a long time to get to be a physician, and dealing with the crises of people, life and death issues, certainly deserves good pay. But $1.78 billion?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every year, and this is speaking for both sides of the fence, I provide health care for my employees and obviously myself. And every year, our premiums go up, our copays go up, our deductibles go up, our coverage goes down, yet my reimbursement as a physician goes down, while
right.
all my expenses go up.
Yeah, so you guys are caught in the squeeze with all the rest of us, and it's the health insurance companies that are making the fortunes.
Yeah. One other thing. I have actually a position paper that I wrote for some political things here that I'd like to send to you. Would that be okay?
Sure. Yeah,
okay. It's kind of a perspective from somebody in the trenches, you know,
sure.
not some think tank.
Yeah, no, I look forward to getting it.
Mark, okay,
got to move along. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Appreciate the call. 1-866-440-8466. Steve in Albany, New York. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind? Steve? No Steve. No Steve. Okay, let's go to Chris in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Chris. Chris is listening to his radio, not his phone, too. How about Alex in New York City?
Hello?
Tom? Hello, Alex.
Hello, Tom. So I'm going to make my point real quick because I know you're up against the break. But I heard this guy Fred Barnes this morning. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's written this book called Rebel in Chief, and they were interviewing...
Fred Barnes is a conservative apologist.
Exactly, but maybe you want to have him on the program in a sense that he's talking about revisionist history, and he talked about how he interviewed the president, and he said, well, who knows what how they're going to judge me in the future? And then he mentioned there have been three biographies about Washington in the last few years, and he's read all of them, and he mentioned 1776, and I just want you to talk about revisionist history.
Okay.
Revisionist history. This is all just not true.
You got it. Alex, thank you very much. Yeah, there's an enormous amount of the rewriting of history going on, and there it has been for a long, long time. I mean, frankly, every generation seems to reinvent history in its own image, or have people within it who try to. It's one of the reasons why I keep just going back to the original source material and encourage people to do so. And go back and read, you know, Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention. It's fascinating stuff. Read the Federalist Papers. Read Jefferson's actual letters. You'll learn a lot. 57 minutes past the hour. And our next hour, Scott Ritter will be taking your calls as well.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, coming up in a few weeks, an interesting milestone on the 25th of November, the birthday of the Bush twins. It will also be, this is their happy birthday gift from their daddy, it will also be the day that we will have been in Iraq one day longer than it took us to fight World War II. From Pearl Harbor to the Japanese surrender. We've already been in Iraq longer than it took us to fight the war in Europe. On the day that Jenna and Barbara have their next birthday, no, they're not going to go out and enlist. Bushes don't do that. Or if they do, they get, you know, cushy. Well, I should acknowledge, you know, Bush Sr. actually was a bomber pilot in World War II. Did his service, Bush Sr. But ever since then, it seems like the whole family's kind of gone to pot. Maybe that's it. Maybe they're smoking too much dope. No, it's, well, we know George was doing cocaine, but that's a whole different thing. That's just toxic. Anyhow, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Steve in Albany, New York. Back to the China issue. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and sorry you couldn't hear me before. I don't know what happened there. I heard you talking about China and holding all of our debt.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about this.
Not all of our debt, but...
not all of our debt, but a lot of our debt.
$700+ billion of it.
Right. Enough to really cause some problems. That's for sure. But... have you considered, or anybody else out there considered, that they could also choose to place trade embargoes on us for our human rights abuses? Now that we've, you know, passed the torture bill and War Criminals Get Out of Free Act.
Yeah, this is the other. It's a black day or a sad day today. George W. Bush this morning in a ceremony in the Rose Garden signed into law the bill that officially made the United States a police state.
Exactly, and a country like China could choose to turn the tables on us like we've done with so many other countries and just say, you know, because you're you're doing these human rights abuses, we're going to place these trade embargoes on you without cashing in any debt at all.
Yeah. I don't think that they would do that. I don't think that they would need to. If the Chinese want to threaten us, they don't have to threaten us by saying we're not going to sell you cheap junk anymore that you could sell at Walmart.
Right.
All they have to do is say we're not going to buy from you anymore your treasury debts. In other words, we're not going to loan you money anymore. And when China is both our major supplier and our major banker. And when your banker has you, they have you.
Absolutely. So I have another quick question for
sure.
You. Do you think that Thomas Jefferson and other founding fathers would be classified as an enemy combatant now?
I don't know what the problem with the term enemy combatant is that it's not specific. I mean, George Bush has the ability to declare anybody that. Certainly, the King of England declared them terrorists. I mean, the equivalent of that day. So, yeah, whether they would be declared that by the U.S. government or not, it's hard to, kind of project backwards. But I think that the larger point is that many of the people, in fact, probably most of the people, who are shooting at us in Iraq and to a large extent in Afghanistan as well, are doing so because they view themselves as nationalist freedom fighters. They view themselves as attempting to throw the occupiers out of their country. And we have this report today that over 70% of the oil coming out of Iraq right now is being brokered and sold by four American oil companies. That's got to really PO the Iraqis. I mean, the average Iraqi person is going, now we know why they're there. Now we know why they came in. Now we know why when George W. Bush was first making the announcement that he was going to attack Iraq, after he said, in 2 hours the bombing's going to commence and all this stuff, and then he turns the camera and he says, now I'd like to speak to the people of Iraq. And instead of saying something like, just lay down your arms and, everything will be fine, we don't want to kill your young men and women, any more than you want to be, shooting us. Instead, he says,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And, everybody in Iraq went, aha, now we know what's up. And we're seeing that happening. So.
Yeah, and the same thing, if you go back to when Iran tried to nationalize their oil, and get out from underneath the thumb of Great Britain, they were trying not to be colonists anymore.
Right, and that's when we sent in the Shah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when we overthrew their elected leadership and sent in the Shah. And
right.
And it was the same thing with Iraq back in the 1950s when we helped bring Saddam Hussein to power, oddly. But then he flipped it again. So, anyhow, Steve, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much for taking it.
You're welcome. A good point and well said. Chris in Seattle, Washington. And I'm going to have to ask Alex to put Chris on. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Tom, I love your show.
Thank you.
And I think you and Air America are making the world a better place. I want to say good job.
Thank you very much.
I, for one, don't change the station during the ads.
Okay, great. Good on you.
There's something that I want to come back to that you were talking about in the last segment about globalization, because it's a topic that I'm hugely passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to do is bring that and put that in a really concrete sense. I spent years and years at one of the world's most influential companies. And outsourcing and globalization, when you're losing your job due to this, it's a very simple process. Is nothing more complicated than logging onto a website. And I want you just to picture a website. You log onto a website, you select the vendor from a list, you type in what you're paying them for and how much you're going to pay them, and you click submit. And there's nothing more complicated to globalization than that. And I think it's one of the most interesting and one of the most profound and substantial things that's facing our society today. And what we need to do is out-innovate our competition, and make no mistake, it is a competition. And until we can out-innovate them, we are going to continue to see those jobs overseas. We're going to continue to see those dollars shipped overseas.
Well, it sounds nice, Chris, but you're ignoring a fundamental reality, and that is that different countries have different fundamental core standards of living that are a consequence of everything from population density to local resource base. I mean, the cost of living, for example, in rural Kansas is different from the cost of living in Manhattan. So are you suggesting that somebody in Manhattan who is you know, trying to make a living based on whatever, you know, their potential income is in Manhattan should just out innovate rural Kansas?
Well, I don't know that I would argue cost of living in quite those terms. If you look at the percent of your personal income that you have to expend on basic things such as food and shelter, what you're going to find in rural India, you have to spend a much higher percentage of your income, over 90%, just on food.
It depends on who you are, and it depends on where you live. But so that Americans can identify with this, let's stay with the analogy of Kansas and New York for a minute. And there are a whole lot of things that are being done in New York because it requires the infrastructure of a major metropolitan center that can't be done in rural Kansas. And those things, you know, financial sector jobs, actually, although some of those are moving out of New York as well. That's exactly correct.
But what happens is as you ship those dollars offshore, it allows that infrastructure, that very infrastructure that you're talking about, to be built in rural India or China or wherever it may be. So the act of that outsourcing allows people to build out those infrastructures as they have to spend less money, less as a percent of their income on things like food and shelter. It enables them to study math and science.
You're absolutely right. And this is why I think that it's incumbent on every country, because there are 6 billion people in the world, and there's never going to be an end to the supply of cheap labor, which means we're going to end up, you know, back in the Charles Dickens world. It becomes incumbent on every country to define the standard of living that they want and take the steps to achieve it, and to have much, if not most, of their economy internally self-sufficient rather than entirely externally self-sufficient, that's the transition that the United States has gone through. You know, 40 years ago, we were largely internally self-sufficient. Now we're almost entirely dependent upon external sources for everything from chips to consumer goods to clothing. I mean, we used to make all that stuff in this country. And when we made that shift, we became vulnerable to the world.
Well, I see a disconnect between the rhetoric that you're talking about when each country makes its decision as to a standard of living. There's probably a free market play in there somewhere. And the actions that we're taking. Because if you take the decision that we as a modern country want to have a first world standard of living, we need to invest in education. We need to invest in K-12. We need to make no child left behind.
I agree with all those things, Chris, but even more important than that, we need to make sure that the core stuff is still made here. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
First we got the bomb, and that was good, because we love peace and motherhood. Then Russia got the bomb, but that's okay, because the balance of power is maintained that way. Who's next? France got the bomb, but don't you grieve, because they're on our side, I believe. China got the bomb, but have no fears, they can't wipe us out for at least 5 years. Who's next? Then Indonesia claimed that they were gonna get one any day. South Africa wants two, that's right. One for the black and one for the white. Who's next?
Oh, man, who's next? Well, it looks like it's North Korea again. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, this carried in the Guardian. British news, not in the U.S. news, oddly enough. But this is the headline, Iraq cancels peace talks after scores more die. Indefinite delay is blow to credibility of government. Militia kills 46 Sunnis after 17 Shia found beheaded. This is by Michael Howard in Erbil and agencies in Baghdad. It's in The Guardian. The unremitting wave of sectarian violence that has greeted the Muslim holy month of Ramadan claims scores more Iraqi lives at the weekend as authorities in Baghdad announced the indefinite postponement of a conference of political leaders seen as crucial to quickly diminishing hopes for national reconciliation. In a terse statement from the Ministry for National Dialogue, the government said the reconciliation conference, which had been scheduled for this Saturday in Baghdad, would be delayed until further notice for, quote, emergency reasons, end quote. And then they note, this in The Guardian, the cancellation is a further blow to the credibility of the national unity government of Nouri al-Maliki. The embattled prime minister has come under intense pressure from the U.S. and Britain, as well as ordinary Iraqis, to halt the communal violence and the activities of armed militias and death squads. And at the same time, here we have George W. Bush saying that he's calling al-Maliki yesterday. He calls him up and he says, as to quote Tony Snow, he told him not to believe rumors that the U.S. had privately given al-Maliki a two-month timetable to shape up. End of quote from Tony Snow. The rumors, actually, came from U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad. Our ambassador is the guy who said that we had given them 2 months to get their act together. And he said it on CNN. So our ambassador goes on CNN and says, we've given them 2 months. And then Bush says, oh, no. We are 2 months now. We're not doing that. This is incredible. Bush is contradicting himself. He's contradicting his own ambassador. This thing is being held together. I'm telling you, this government in Iraq is being held together with bubble gum and rubber bands. It is on the edge of exploding or imploding, if it hasn't already. I mean, you're not hearing about meetings of parliament and all that kind of. They're all hanging out in the green zone, scared to death to go out. al-Maliki, I mean, several of his people have been killed. I mean, it's gone. It's over the top. You got Jack Murtha. I mean, he's been saying this for what, a year? John Reed, Jack Reed, Senator John Warner, Senator Chuck Hagel. I mean, Republicans. Say what?
Said the internet's back on.
Uh-huh. Okay. James Baker, Colin Powell. I mean, right across. It's mind-boggling. I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's tragic, is what it is, that we got into this war so that George W. Bush could have political advantage. As Cindy Sheehan testified before the Conyers Commission.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
Yeah, indeed. And all the more is the tragedy. And here we are. I mean, here we are now with this just, you know, slow motion disaster going on that has led to the deaths of over 600,000 human beings by best estimates. And this is a group that went in and actually did interviews and actually asked to see death certificates. 600,000. I mean, if this doesn't qualify as a genocide, 600,000 human beings, not to mention millions who have been displaced. We have to change this policy. I mean, this is, and we have to hold these guys accountable, the Bush administration accountable for what they've done. George W. Bush has committed, in my opinion, a serious war crime. I mean, this is a major breach of international, of the codes of international conduct, invading another country that represents absolutely no danger or threat to you. This is just wrong. And are we fixing to do the same in Iran? Scott Ritter coming up next. We'll be talking with him. We'll see how this one is going to go. 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Play by the rules, you're going to miss all the fun, boy.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Announcing the October Surprise Contest, by the way, on our message blogs. First person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members can vote on the winner and four runners-up. Each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed. The winner will be announced November 13th. And, oh, there we go. Sorry about that. And it's like, where's that coming from? And you can find out all about it over at our website at tomhartman.com. And just click on the blogs area there. Looks like Scott Ritter is going to be with us an hour from now rather than right now. His schedule is going a little crazy, as they say. I want to get back to this issue of what's happening to the American middle class and how and why. I was talking earlier about this giant trade deficit, this huge gap with China, and not just with China, but with countries all over the world. And because we are, and this is the point that I was trying to make to the caller who called in a little while ago, because we are no longer making things here, under the rubric of free trade, under this weird idea of global, quote, free trade, end quote. And there's always been trade, right? But let's do it with no rules. What has happened is that the manufacturing of things, and to a large extent, even the doing of things. I mean, there's physicians reading x-rays in India right now for hospitals in the United States over the Internet. The doing of things and the making of things is leaving the United States and is arriving in countries where the labor is cheaper. And with 6 billion people in the world, I mean, right now there's only about 1.5 billion of the world's population who are in play in this game. Most of the world's population has not yet been exploited, has not yet been tapped for this cheap labor. I mean, there's huge barrios in South and Central America. There's large, vast and teeming slums in the major cities of Africa. There's enormous pools of cheap labor in Central Asia that have not yet been brought in to compete against, you know, for example, the Chinese or against American workers. But they will, as long as there's a need for manufacturing and manufacturers can go anywhere. And this is why traditionally what countries did was they said, you know, if we're going to have a country, if the idea of a nation has integrity, if it's a good idea for there to be a nation, then we want to make sure that our nation can at least be self-sufficient. Now, this is an extension of the idea of if we're going to have a family, then the family should be self-sufficient. If you're going to have a farm, you have to have the ability to eat and to run the thing. I'm thinking of my wife's grandmother, who died just a few years ago in her 90s, sharp to the very end. And, you know, grandma, she had a farm during the Great Depression, family farm in Michigan, in central Michigan, and they kind of didn't notice the Great Depression. Because before, during, and after the Great Depression, grandma bought a dress from Sears every year and bought sugar and salt. And that was it. Because they grew their own food, they had their own meat, they got their own milk, they made their own dairy products, they made a lot of their own clothing. I mean, it was just, they were self-sufficient. So if the idea of a nation existing is one that we're going to embrace, and this is where it really breaks down, is fundamentally the folks like Tom Friedman are saying there shouldn't be any such thing as a nation. A nation is a convenient, it's a convenient label. It's a convenient economic block. But the idea of a nation in and of itself is fundamentally flawed. This is the argument. This is the logic behind Tom Friedman and the World is Flat bunch. And whether it's the George Herbert Walker Bush New World Order or whether it's Bill Clinton and global free trade, they're all part of the same international corporatist regime. And the logic behind that regime is that the idea of a nation is quaint and outmoded. Now, here's why they would argue that's the case. They say, well, we live in an interdependent world and everybody's dependent upon each other. And that's actually a good thing because it's going to lead to world peace. Because if everybody is dependent upon everybody else, then people are less likely to go to war with each other. That's the rationale of the kind of one world crowd. Now, there is, you know, a lot to be said for the idea of we don't want to go to war with each other, and we put together the United Nations for that purpose. But the United Nations is not an economic body. It's a political body. So the folks who economically want there to be only one country in the world, that is the United States of the World or the World Trade Organization, they say, well, you know, national boundaries, you know, it's all very nice and people want to have their languages and they want to have their culture and we'll let them have that. But when it comes to money, there is only one world. This is their worldview. Now, who does that benefit? So you could say, well, you know, there's a single world government and it'll put the world at peace. Wouldn't that be a marvelous thing? The whole world is at peace. Sure. You will recall in 1936 that Adolf Hitler very clearly said that his goal was to create 1,000 years of peace worldwide. That the entire world would come under the rule of the Nazi regime eventually. And this would produce 1,000 years of peace. See, I would argue that there is something to be said, in fact, a lot to be said, for the checks and balances of independent states existing as independent states, for the dynamic tension of independent states existing as independent states. Yes, interdependent with regard to trade and politics and other things, but not dependent. That the United States and every other country, frankly, has an obligation to organize its trade policies in such a way that it has the ability to be independent, to function independently. So we still make our own clothing, so that we still make our own steel, so that we still make our own tools, so that we still make our own consumer goods. And what does that do? That puts us to work in the United States. And so we're trading with ourselves and we're buying things from ourselves and we're hiring ourselves. And you know, the circle is complete within the United States. And then when we trade with the rest of the world, it's not to get a better price, because that ultimately hurts us, because now the wages are going offshore. It's to get products that we couldn't otherwise get. You know, nobody in the United States is going to grow French wine. That's French wine. In the United States, we don't have a sandalwood industry. If you want sandalwood, you import it from Thailand, particularly if it's carved and pretty and things like that. You know, Chinese calligraphy, well, I suppose it could be done here. But you get the point, that this was the argument that was made back in the 1700s that Adam Smith talked about in Wealth of Nations. That countries should trade for strategic reasons, but not purely for economic reasons. Because when the decisions are made by economic powers, by corporations, and they're saying, okay, the trade policy is going to be so that my company can get richer, not the government, we the people, collectively say, no, our trade policy is going to be so that we can all have jobs and we can all make things, then you're in trouble. What we need to go back to in the United States, and frankly, this is a debate that's raging in Europe right now, because the Europeans are seeing the result of the consolidation through the European Union and jobs fleeing the wealthy countries, manufacturing fleeing wealthy countries and going to poorer countries. And it's producing these huge social cracks like you're seeing in France right now, for example, where we saw in France a few months ago with the riots. We're seeing in the United Kingdom. And then that poverty fuels the radicals at the fringe. And you end up with what? Terrorism. And as America declines, you know, slides into increasing poverty, we are, you know, growing our own terrorists. By and large, up to this point, most of our homegrown terrorists have been the Tim McVeighs, the people who are trying to bring about the rapture and trying to bring down the government through crazy means. But we must go back to a policy where we say, okay, we're going to make things in this country. And the only way you can do that, frankly, that I know of, now maybe somebody can educate me about something else, but I have been looking. The only way to do that is the way that we did it in this country for over 200 years. And that's through the use of tariffs. It's a very straightforward process. Otherwise, you have what we have. I mean, since 1980, 13,546 U.S. companies have been sold to corporations or interests outside the United States. A total of $1,674,883,000,000 worth of American wealth, American companies, American manufacturing is now owned by companies in other countries. Now, you know, at the surface, that sounds xenophobic, but here's where it's bad. It's bad because the purpose of running a company is to make a profit. And that profit should be invested back into the economy that it came from. But in this case, all of these companies are taking the profit outside the United States. And thus, the United States becomes poorer. 45 minutes past the hour.
Selling out is easy to do. It's not so hard to find a buyer for you. When money talks, you're under its spell. Ah, but what do you have when there's nothing left to sell? Selling out,
I'd rather call it compromise,
is easy to do.
Sometimes you have to close your eyes.
It's not so hard.
Indeed. Actually, over at HuffingtonPost.com, there's an interesting blog or post by Ariana, Ned Lamont's concession speech, where he's saying, you know, I lost because I ran to the middle. I listened to the political advisors. No, Ned Lamont's, not Lieberman's. And I believe. And increasingly what we're seeing is these political advisors saying, run to the middle, run to the middle. And the only thing in the middle of the road is a yellow stripe and dead armadillos, to quote Jim Hightower. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Ellen, today we saw the end of democracy in the United States as we knew it and the beginning of a police state. What happened in the Rose Garden is what I think happened.
That is absolutely true. Let me just make a comment on Ned Lamont, which is that he just added another million of his own bucks to the campaign.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad to hear it. It makes me crazy when progressives are afraid to be progressives.
A friend of mine who's a good Republican just emailed me both a story about Lynn Stewart only getting 28 months and the fact that they felt was a slap in the face to the Justice Department, and also that what's happening with today's signing in the Rose Garden of the Military Commissions Act of 2006 is that essentially this is just going into how did they get the information on Lynn Stewart? They wiretapped her. How are they getting any of this information? They're wiretapping people. And so this is going on, and he just put it right now into legislation.
Right, and this goes back to a piece that I wrote 6 months ago for Common Dreams, where the Democrats so completely shot themselves in the foot. They had this huge opportunity handed to them when word came out that Bush was illegally wiretapping people without warrants to do the Nixon thing, to pull the Nixon card, to say, which Democrats is Bush wiretapping? We want to know right now, which Democrats is he listening in on? You know, how many of us is he listening in on? And they didn't.
Well, let me tell you something to sort of go along with that. It's very interesting if you look at the Foley case now and you look at the Weldon case. It's clear it's not Democrats. I have understood that they are letting this information out. They're leaking this information out because the Bush administration, from what I'm hearing from some of my operatives, would rather lose this election and punish people like Weldon, who did not agree with the Bush administration on some of the 9/11 stuff, like Bob May, who voted against the Patriot Act, and they're going after people who do not carry the party line, because their view is that party loyalty is going to be worth more to them than anything else.
Well, I agree that they're willing to punish these folks. I don't think that they're going to lose the election, though. I take Karl Rove at his word that he knows that he's going to win this election. And I think the fix is in.
Well, if the fix is in, then, even though that there have been several polls that have done that have shown that there's a 5-point advantage that the Democrats have.
Yeah,
but
nationally,
that hasn't even
but
been
if
held
you go
since 93.
Yeah, nationally. But if you go race by race and you look at the individual races, those races where it's possible that the Democrats could win, the Republicans have huge structural advantages, even assuming that they haven't rigged voting machines. I'm setting that aside for the moment. You have secretaries of state, like in Ohio, who are throwing people off the voting rolls left and right. You have states passing laws, you know, ID laws and things, making it harder for people
like
to vote.
Like in Tennessee.
Right. I mean, you know, what they're doing is they're going in, and basically it's Jim Crow all over again. They're going to make it harder and harder for Democrats to vote, or for people to vote in general. I mean, this is an old Republican strategy. Ellen, this is Paul Weyrich. You know who Paul Weyrich is.
Oh, I just saw him the other day in the restaurant.
Okay, the Republican strategist. Well, here's Paul Weyrich speaking in a church some years ago about the Republican strategy. He's talking to a group of Republican strategists. Let me just start this again. Here.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
There you go. From his own words.
Knowing him as well as I do, I'm not terribly surprised.
Yeah, but that's the Republican strategy, is to drive down the vote. They do it with negative advertising. They do it by throwing people off the voting rolls. They do it by making it harder to vote. And I am fully expecting that they are going to steal this election by right out in the open, just like they did the last three elections, right out in the open. And, I mean, this stuff is, like, well-documented by John Conyers, even setting aside the possibility of machine theft, all the structural stuff. And so they feel that they can afford to punish a couple of Republicans, a couple of wayward Republicans.
And that's what they're doing is Rove is looking into long-term party loyalty, and he's saying you step out, you don't vote the right way, you're gone.
Right. They're
and
recreating.
We'll come after you.
Yeah, they're recreating the Politburo. They're recreating
right.
A one-party state. They're creating here the Soviet Union all over again. And for those of our listeners old enough to remember the Soviet Union, and that's a truly scary thing that is going on there. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, thanks so much for being with
Thank
us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 56 minutes past there. We'll be back with your calls and a little more discussion on trade. I want to wrap up, you know, that rant. And Laura Flanders is going to be with us from Air America Radio. And she and I are both going to be on a panel at Bioneers this coming weekend. And then Scott Ritter will be with us at the bottom of the hour. So stick around. It should be a fascinating hour coming up here. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, helping you win the water cooler wars. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman Radio Program, 6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. This weekend, the Bioneers will be having their big annual conference, a big hoop-de-doop in Marin County, California. And Laura Flanders and I will both be there. We're going to be on a panel together talking about the stories that we tell ourselves. Laura is a print and radio journalist, currently with the Air America Radio Network, the author of Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, and Real Majority, Real Minority. Her website, airamericaradio.com. And I'm assuming, Laura, welcome to the program, first of all.
I'm dying to hear the assumptions.
I'm assuming you have your own website, Beyond Air America.
I do. One better, patent one, at lauraflanders.com.
Yeah, which makes perfect sense.
And the radio show is called Radio Nation, and you can find that website, too, if you really want to check out them all, radionation.org. Great to be with you, Tom. I'm looking forward to this weekend.
Well, me too, and it's great to have you here with us, Laura. The panel that we're going to be talking about is, or that we're going to be talking on at the conference in San Rafael on, I think it's Friday, is it Friday afternoon?
Friday afternoon.
Yeah. Is about when stories change, the world changes. And I'm wondering what, we can kind of do a preliminary here on this. I'm curious what you think are the most useful and the most destructive stories, memes, as it were, you know, foundational myths, cultural myths, that are extant in the United States right now.
Well, you know, I think the most exciting story that's out there right now is that there, as I think you would agree, is a kind of rising tide of progressive activism that's going to remake this damn Democratic Party and maybe remake the political scene. The most devastating story is the one that we all battle with in those darkest nights before the dawn, darkest hours before the dawn, which is it's all hopeless, the voting machines are rigged, and, you know, what can any of us do? I think those are the two. That's exactly where I find myself every day, somewhere in between those two. I hope on most days I veer towards the optimistic and away from the other one. But I think both, in fact, are true.
Yeah. In fact, I had a conversation over the weekend with a friend of one of my kids, a 27-year-old young man. You know, he's in college, working on a graduate degree, and is not going to vote. He's not even going to register to vote. And I'm like, why? And now I live in Oregon where, you know, we don't have voting machines. It's vote by mail.
They're still counted by machines.
Yeah, they are. But he doesn't live in Oregon. And he was like, well, you know, we vote with machines in this state and you can't trust them. So why should I bother? And I know that one of the main reasons why the Democratic Party has treated the whole idea of vote fraud as if it was radioactive is because their internal polling and psychographic analysis has indicated that if that meme gets out there as a major meme in the, particularly on the left, that response that I heard from this young man this weekend is exactly the response that they're going to see right across the board.
Right. Well, my response to the Democratic Party on that is, you know, what is discouraging people more than anything is not the fear that the machines are no good, but the fear that nobody cares and that the Democratic Party is oblivious to the problems. I think, you know, there are two ways. There, you know, the reality is this is a midterm election where we're going to see play out the worst that we can expect in terms of the impact of new voting technology. I don't believe the GOP is smart enough to have this stuff totally rigged to their benefit. I do believe that a year in which you've got, you know, two-thirds of all precincts using new technology, you're going to see chaos. This is a time for people, progressives, people who want change in this country to be there at the polls. This is a year we've got to do a whole lot more than just vote. We have to be there and watch what happens. And there is every kind of way, fascinatingly enough, for regular civilians like you and me and everybody who listens to this program, simply by being present in the polls, in the polling stations, to sound an alarm. You can be a witness to what happens and testify about it later. You can ask at the end of the day, and I didn't know whether you knew this, Tom, but I was in Florida, and the Miami-Dade Voter Reform Coalition has figured out that it is legal for civilian, non-professional observers to show up at the precincts at the end of the election day and ask to be shown the record of how many voters signed in, and the record of how many votes were registered by the machines. And if there is a disparity between those two things, there should be no disparity. We're not even talking who voted for what. If there is a disparity, that can be enough to require a manual count of the results. And what they found in the last election, 02, was that 75% of precincts in Miami-Dade, there was a disparity from a handful of votes to more than 100. That's enough to switch an election. So if we can get Democrats in office this fall, you and I, you know I'm not a big fan of the Democratic establishment. I am a huge fan of people like John Conyers and Henry Waxman, and you're going to see those folks, the Progressive Caucus veterans are placed to head up some very important committees this fall.
So if
nothing else, you're voting for a progressive in an important committee position and in a position where they could call for a review of all this technology. So if you're concerned about the machines, this is a time to get more active, not less.
Right, and to participate at velvetrevolution.us or electiondefensealliance.org.
That's right.
You know, some of these groups that are going to actually go out there with video cameras on Election Day and try to document exactly what's going on. On the other hand, there are some states where they have created institutional barriers to this. In Ohio, for example, in the last election, there was one of the European Union organizations that came over to observe the election, and they went back and said, we can't certify that this election was up to the standards of a third world country,
right,
because Ken Blackwell wouldn't let us within 100 feet of the polling place.
Right, and if we had John Conyers heading up the Judiciary Committee or Henry Waxman heading up the Government Affairs Committee, that person would be brought in front of Congress to testify.
Yeah,
it's never going to happen as long as Blackwell's in charge.
Yeah, it would be an absolutely completely different thing. Let's just shift a little bit. First of all, we're in agreement here that people need to get out in as large a number as possible, and it's not enough to just vote this time around. People need to be showing up at county Democratic offices and saying, I'm here, I'll go canvass, I'll go door to door and knock on doors.
Because the point is to fix this before 08.
Absolutely. On Election Day and in the days leading up to Election Day, MoveOn.org has this huge program to mobilize voters where people can participate in this, and they can basically run phone banks, be your own phone bank, kind of thing. And I just, in fact, I got an email this morning from George W. Bush. And it said, you have an email from back. This is, I'm sure, one of these days it's going to come back to haunt me. But 3 years ago, when I was living in Vermont, I gave $5 to the Republican Party. And I did that because I wanted to get on their mailing list. I was, mm-hmm. I was doing progressive talk radio at the time. It was on Sirius and IE America Radio Network. This was before Air America came along. And I just wanted to get the stuff that all the Republicans were getting. And someday somebody will say, here, we've got the record. Hartman is a Republican. So he gave $5 to the Republican Party in Vermont. But in any case, so I get all this junk and certainly my $5 worth. And today what I got was an email from George W. Bush, and it said, dear Thomas R. Hartman, because I put the R in there, so I don't know if they sold my name to any other mailing list, because I'm getting stuff from anti-abortion groups, Thomas R. Hartman, R for Republican, right? Mm. And it's just fascinating to watch how this $5 is spreading out. But it directed me, this email from George W. Bush, which actually is kind of weird, because he's the president of the United States. I don't think that he should be doing that as a partisan official, but that's a whole other argument.
Better he be doing that than trying to run the country.
Well, arguably. But in any case, what it clicked me to was a site called something like the 72-hour...
That's right.
Project.
Whatever,
the project, exactly. Where I could plug in my name and address and zip code and commit to a two-hour period throughout the day, and they would feed me the names and phone numbers of people to call in my community so that it would be a kind of a peer-to-peer thing. And they're launching a major get-out-the-vote move, and it's all happening under the radar.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And let's not forget that's exactly, in fact, what happened last time. While the New York Times and others were writing articles, for example, about the great job that Move On and ACT and everybody was doing registering voters in Ohio and other swing states, and flying in, volunteers from the Bay Area to go work the heartland, what the Republicans have been doing over the last, I wouldn't say just 2 years, really the last 20, is building up a state-based activist movement that his base, in part, is certainly helped by the Christian churches, but it's not limited to that. And that 72-hour project, it wasn't just they had more, money. They had team leaders for every precinct in 04, and it worked. They had a direct connection to the candidates' campaigns.
And this is what Dean is trying to do.
We've got to work the same sort of thing.
Yeah, this is what Dean is trying to do right now, this 50-state strategy, and we need to be supporting that. Laura Flanders, RadioNation.com, LauraFlanders.com, AirAmericaRadio.com, and I look forward to seeing you Friday afternoon.
Me too. Come buy an ear with me.
Indeed. And buy an ears. Thanks so much.
Bye.
It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Hey!
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466. Our phone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room or our message boards. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. I'd actually called about decentralization, but after you talked about with Laura, I'd like to continue with voting.
Sure.
First of all, with the Fradycrats, which Lamont seems to be becoming, it's really strange. Well, there's a good quote I heard a few days ago that said, a Democrat is a person who won't even take his own side in a fight.
Yeah, tragically, that's what Rahm Emanuel is trying to turn the Democratic Party into. I mean, this is the DLC worldview, is that Democrats have to become Republicans light. And every time a progressive unabashedly runs as a progressive, they win, even in red states like Brian Schweitzer in Montana. But when Democrats try to become DLC Democrats, they lose consistently.
Every time I give a lecture and I mention that the reason, like when someone says, oh, we don't want to mention impeachment, it might offend somebody, and I say, hey, we've got to stand up and be very brave. We've been wimps. That's how we got that way.
Yeah.
Nearly get standing ovations.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to be talking about impeachment. In fact, we had this conversation yesterday or the day before with what was her name? The former member of Congress who's written a book about impeachment. And she said, this election is all about whether or not George W. Bush is going to be impeached. That's what this election is about. And if Democrats take a majority in this election, Bush will be impeached. And if they don't, he won't. And that's what it boils down to. And not just Bush, Bush and Cheney as well. And Nancy Pelosi could end up president of the United States. And I think that would be a marvelous thing, frankly.
Yeah. And there's a key dialogue to have with people, such as that guy who said he wouldn't vote. First of all, I ask people, how much is the future of the world, how important is it to you, and how bad are things today? Do we need to change the government? They say yes. I say, okay, you've got a situation. One case, your vote is guaranteed not to count. The other situation, it may count, it may not. But if you don't vote, it's guaranteed your vote doesn't count.
Right.
So
right.
Is the future of the world... Yeah, it's a petty thing to.
I know, but I have heard this so many times talking to folks in their 20s, and that seems to be where it's at, folks in their mid 20s, that there's this sense
of. And they guarantee their vote. Won't count.
Hell with it. You know, it's like, it's almost despair.
Yeah.
And we have to figure out a way to cut through that. I don't know if it's John Stewart to do it or if it's me or it's you, Jeff, but we have to cut through it. Jeff, I got to move along. Got a bunch of calls here, but I appreciate the call and thanks for checking in with us today. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I have two questions. One of them is really quick. You know when you say the Republicans only help the wealthiest 1% of America? What exactly is that yearly income that we're talking about?
To be in the top 1%, it's a little over $300,000 a year, I believe.
$300,000 a year, okay. And then what I really called about was I heard you say this a few minutes ago with Laura Flanders, and I've heard lots of progressives say this, and I don't really see how it can help. We come out in mass numbers and vote. Well, if we were voting on the popular vote only, I could see how that would work. But with the Electoral College, I don't see how that can make any difference.
Well, the Electoral College is not even in use in this election. The Electoral College is only used for the presidency. And so,
oh, I forgot about that. I know that.
So,
oh, okay.
So we're voting for our individual members of Congress, and then they're going to, if the Democrats get a majority, then in either branch, in the House or the Senate, then they will have the power to compel testimony, to issue subpoenas.
Absolutely.
They will,
okay,
and
I
then we'll get some answers.
Now.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just totally zoned out.
Nah, it's quite all right. It happens to me all the time.
Thank you.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Mark in Arcata, California. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah, about the consolidation of political power and global capital.
Yeah.
It can be discouraging. However, I'm optimistic myself because, as you said, you made a very good point that both administrations have been pushing for the neoliberalization of global trade, excuse me, which has basically allowed for the consolidation of political and material capital. But in that fact lies a great deal of power, because on the other side of those trade policies are both Republican and Democrat constituents who constitute a supermajority, who believe we're having our constitutional rights subverted But
yeah, the problem is that they're being fed this line by guys like Tom Friedman that somehow it's in our national interest to go along with the idea that we should simply throw our borders open and allow absolute unregulated trade.
But positive word up is that a great deal of both sides of the aisle, the constituencies, are both disillusioned and are ready to enforce the law, meaning the constitutional law which guarantees that the Fed, investment bankers, brokerage houses, and hedge funds cannot dictate our economy in this country. That's why we fought a war 230 years ago, the Revolutionary War.
I know, but that's what's going on right now. I mean, we've reached the point.
Sure.
Kevin Phillips documents this in his most recent book. We've reached a point now where arbitrage is a more important part of our economy than manufacturing.
It's
where,
illegal.
You know, the moving, where there's more moving of money going on. Mark, thank you for the call. It's an important point that you make, and unfortunately we're out of time to continue the conversation with it, but we'll come back to it. We'll come back to it. Scott Ritter coming up next. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain.
Scientists say our climate's in a warming trend. And if we keep cutting down the forests, we will surely meet our end. We should do business in an eco-friendly way, but that would cost too much, so all I've got to say is come on, come on, come on, come on.
Slash it!
The billionaires for Bush, they know what's going on. Nothing to worry about, my friends. Let's just cut down the planet. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Scott Ritter on the line with us, UNSCOM senior weapons inspector in Iraq between 1991 and 1998. He has a new book out, Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change. It's available through Nation Books, nationbooks.org. And Scott, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Geez, we've been talking on the radio for the better part of 4 years now. I remember back on this program when you were predicting that the United States would be invading Iraq. Are we having the same conversation today, Scott?
Well, it's a similar conversation because it's the same policy. And that's what a lot of people need to recognize is that, you know, you can't separate Iraq from Iran regardless of, you know, what Condoleezza Rice and others say. It's part and parcel of an overall policy objective of regional transformation in the Middle East. And, you know, the Bush administration has clearly articulated its intent in two versions of a national security strategy document. They've acted on this intent in the case of Iraq. And so I think that we need to take seriously the probability that they will act on their intent vis-a-vis Iran.
The USS Eisenhower and a battle group associated with it are on their way right now to the Persian Gulf. The official reason, and I understand they're to arrive on the 25th of October, the official reason is to relieve the existing, what is it, the USS Enterprise and battle group that is there now, I believe?
Right.
And let those guys go, you know, leave the Gulf and go on R&R. Do you buy that?
Yeah, of course. You rotate out the armed forces. Look, the Eisenhower, even reinforcing the Enterprise in and of itself, does not constitute sufficient military force to sustain any meaningful military action against Iran. You know, if they were putting every carrier battle group in theater, if they were flowing in logistics to sustain, you know, tactical air fighter wings, bomber squadrons, etc., then I'd be scratching my head saying, aha, I think something's going on here. You know, that's what was happening in the fall of 2002, which is why I was firing the red flares up repeatedly, saying, look, mm-hmm. we are seeing the massive movement of military forces.
Right.
This means that war is on the horizon. We're not seeing that right now. And therefore, you know, I don't I'm not pressing the panic button. There's a couple things that need to occur. We need to see a major diplomatic offensive take place where we secure the basing rights for the logistics and the aircraft and the armed forces necessary to not only initiate but to sustain. And that's an important fact. It's not about the first day of fighting. It's about the fifth week of fighting, because any military action against Iran will be sustained. And we need basing rights that will allow us to sustain this. There has to be political preparation done here at home. As much as we
criticize
Bush,
the Iranians.
Pardon?
We have to vilify the Iranians.
And we have to get Congress to basically underwrite the war. Now, we know in October of 2002, Congress abrogated their constitutional responsibilities, not only giving the president a green light to go against Iraq, or October 2001, I'm sorry. They said basically the president can do anything he wants to hunt terror down. Mm-hmm. And the president has successfully defined within the framework of U.S. policy structure Iran as a state sponsor of terror. The most current manifestation of the National Security Strategy document lists Iran 16 times.
What they're saying is essentially that this authority that was given them before can be used now against Iran without the requirement of new authority.
Absolutely. Now, but what's important here is that the president does need to solidify his base, because while he can initiate action, sustaining that action requires Congress to continue underwriting it to the tune of many, many billions of dollars. One of the reasons why Congress continues to rubber stamp the disaster in Iraq is that they voted for it, and therefore no member of the Senate, no member of the House of Representatives who voted for this war wants to sit back and say, well, now I'm not going to fund it, because they'll be accused of abandoning the troops that they themselves put in harm's way.
Right.
And I think the president knows that he needs to get Congress lined up with this adventure in Iran. And the sad thing is, despite all that's gone bad in Iraq, I see no indication that Congress, the majority of Congress, will show any tendency to resist the president on the issue of Iran. We've already vilified them. We're like what the case was with Iraq. We as a nation are pre-programmed to accept anything that's negative about Iran at face value without question.
Are you suggesting or guessing that this is going to be something that will play out politically over the course of the next year and then begin probably militarily toward the end of 2007, which will be a nice setup for the Republicans for the 2008 election?
No, I think it's actually going to be much more aggressive than that. This is something that will play out politically almost immediately following the November elections this year. I see a window of opportunity opening in March of 2007 and closing around June of 2007.
You mean a military window of opportunity?
That's correct. And if they don't act during this window, it's like anything. You take a football team and you train it. It's ready to play a game. If you don't play the game, all that training goes down.
Right. People start getting flabby.
It's gone. And so now we, because I don't believe Bush is going to make a move before the election, this is all science, the art of war. Basically, from November to March is the preparatory phase. March, the window opens. The window closes in June. If we don't act in that window, then we got to start the process all over again. And so, these things run in cycles. And I'm very concerned that the Bush administration has every intention of moving aggressively against Iran, inclusive of military force. Remember, this is a president who has said he doesn't want to leave the Iranian problem for the next administration.
Yeah, we're talking with Scott Ritter. He has a new book out titled Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change, nationbooks.org for more information about that. Scott, you just got back from Iran. What did you learn?
Well, we got to be careful about trying to learn too much on a short visit. It was a one-week visit. I had great access, but I don't want to let anybody believe that I conducted some sort of massive in-depth study that's going to change the whole nature of the way we assess Iran. I'll just say, from a personal perspective, as somebody who had been successfully programmed to be anti-Iranian, my eyes were opened wide. I didn't go in there ready to be hoodwinked by the Iranians and accepted face value anything they threw at me. I was expecting a police state, though, and when I got off the airplane and went through customs, I entered an environment, and I've been in Middle East dictatorships, an environment totally free of that massive, overwhelming sense of oppression. I had free movement, totally free movement in this country. I could meet who I wanted to meet. I could take pictures of what I wanted to take pictures of.
You can't do that here anymore.
You can't do that here. You know, and yes, they do shut down newspapers. Yes, they do oppress people. I'm not sitting here extolling the virtues of Iranian society. But, you know, they're satellite dishes. They're watching Western media. They all have cell phones. Imagine that, a dictatorship with cell phones where they text message each other. They have internet access. They can download anything they want from around the world and email it to their friends. There is the free flow of information in this society that is unparalleled in almost every other society in the Middle East, especially every other Muslim society. It's a very modern, a very westernized, and surprisingly very pro-American society. So I came out of that saying, my God, there's something wrong here. The media is not getting this right. If I go there for a week and I see this reality, why isn't that being captured by our media? Why when we
why
turn
isn't
on the
it?
TV? Pardon?
Why isn't it, in your opinion?
Because, again, the media, Scott. The media doesn't have the guts to sit there and explain reality to the American people. They have to dumb everything down. They take the easiest path. And again, because corporate media is beholden to the politicians in power for continued access to the news that makes their product viable on the market, they don't want to go out and decisively contradict the picture being painted by policymakers. And policymakers are painting Iran as the bad guys.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that war is incredibly profitable for the media.
Unfortunately, you're right.
Yeah, it brings all kinds of eyeballs and incredible ratings. Scott Ritter, his new book is Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change Implicitly in Iran. Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hang on. Hey, Scott? Nope, we lost Scott. Okay. I thought I had a minute. Yeah, there we go. I was going to say that. Oh, well. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 45 minutes past there. I'll be right back.
I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can see me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah!
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change in America. Let's take a look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Security and other developments in Iraq reported on Tuesday as of 08:30 GMT by Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, a mortar round landed near Al-Wathiq Square in central Baghdad, killing two people and wounding three policemen. 65 bodies were found in different districts of Baghdad, an Interior Ministry source said. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army arrested 10, quote, terrorists, end quote, and 31 suspected insurgents in different parts of Iraq during the last 24 hours. In Haditha, police found the bodies of four people with gunshot wounds and signs of torture. In Mosul, gunmen shot dead Mufta al-Merki, a member of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, PUK, in a drive-by shooting in that northern city. And in Baghdad, a mortar round landed in a residential district and killed a man and wounded 10 others on Monday night. A new Fox News Opinion Dynamics poll found that nearly 3 in 4 Americans, 73%, agree that U.S. troops should start to come home. We'll see how that gets reported on faux news. And, well, it's just Tony Snow. This is grim. You know, Senator John, this is from thinkprogress.org. Senator John Warner, one of President Bush's staunchest allies, now says we are moving sideways and backwards in Iraq. Hagel agrees. So Tony Snow is asked, are we winning? Snow, we're making progress. I don't know. How do you define winning? Whew. Oh, my. It is a tragedy of mind-boggling proportions. That's the bottom line. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Yeah, quickly, two things. I want to talk about this boycotting of Republican businesses. But first, that audio link you play of Paul Weyrich.
Weyrich, yeah.
Do you have it on your site?
No, I don't.
Because I think to link that to send, so bloggers can send that to like Olbermann, so we can get that out to expose that they don't believe in democracy.
Well, I got it off the internet in the first place. I would guess that you could easily Google it.
What would you Google? Just Weyrich audio
Paul,
clip?
Paul Weyrich and MP3, or Paul Weyrich on voter suppression, or something like that. You know,
if we could get that audio clip, especially like Olbermann on national TV, to expose this, that they're not for democracy.
The problem is Olbermann would want a video clip. But you know, I get your point, I can put it on my website.
Now, back to the only way, you know, Republicans only understand money, the language of money, property over people. The only way these guys are going to get it is to boycott their businesses, just like during the Republican Great Depression. They were ostracized and shunned. You ask, go into a business, you ask, are you Republican? He says, yeah, I'm not doing business with you. It's got to get to that point, just like these churches who want to, voice their opinion on public policy. Well, then they got to pay the admission price and tax their butt. So Republicans, we should shun them, ostracize them, and not patronize their businesses. It has to get to that gut level. You're not getting my money.
The problem is identifying those Republican businesses, because, you know, a business will one year contribute to the Republicans, next year they'll contribute to the Democrats. You know, the bottom line here, Tom, is that there is a small number of businesses that can be clearly identified in the category that you're talking
during
about.
During the Republican Great Depression, hey, people they didn't want to admit that they voted Republican.
Yeah.
And they were ostracized, and people knew who they were. And when they start knowing that, hey, the population, they're not going to spend their money in our place.
Yeah.
It has to get to that point, because these clowns only understand the language of money.
It seems like a starting point, and good one on you, Tom. Ravi in Chile, New Mexico. Hey, Ravi.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Fine. What's up?
I was kind of wanting to talk to Mr. Ritter. I kind of think his timetable is off. You know, I think the October surprise could, like, come this weekend or early next week with the arrival of the Eisenhower there.
No, see, I agree with him, and this is what I've talked about on this show before. Karl Rove told us, basically, that he was going to replay the 2002 scenario. And the 2002 scenario was, you talk real loudly about Iran. I would expect that over the next 3 weeks there's going to be a lot of loud talk about Iran. And there's going to be a lot of demonizing of Iran and further polarizing of the American people and further characterization of Democrats as you know, wimps and afraid of war and, you know, all that kind of stuff. He's not going to take the chance of military action that might go wrong before an election.
So you get
the invasion the following spring, which is exactly what happened in 2002.
Well, what they're coming with now is Iran is ratcheting up their rhetoric. And now they're saying that they're going to do a preemptive. So it could go either way.
I have not heard Iran say that. I'm hearing North Korea say that.
No, Iran has said that. Khamenei,
yeah. He's going to do a preemptive strike against who?
Of the American fleet.
Well, it could go either way. Where did you see that? Have you?
Debka file.
Yeah. Okay. I'll keep an eye out for that. But I haven't seen that reported in any credible sources. I may be wrong. I'll look for it. Ravi, thanks for the call. We've got to wrap up the show here. But coming up on tomorrow's program, I'll be challenging conservative Yaron Brook, who says New York has no right to force restaurants to cut back on deadly trans fats. And Jeffrey Feldman is here with the frame, "The Stakes Are High." That, of course, the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
been listening to the Tom Hartman Program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.